Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I am joined by Gary Astrich, who is a historian and curator of all things Ringo. Gary, how are you?
Very well, Bart. Nice to talk to you.
You too. Thanks for being on the show. Ringo is one of those drummers that is just, I mean, he is one of the most well-known and famous and I would say best drummers in the world. And I know that's debatable when people compare him to guys like, you know, Buddy Rich or something, but I'd say he is just, he made drums what they are today. So this is great.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think I'm a little bit jaded, but being a Beatles fan, Ringo's fan from a very young age, you know, I grew up with them and knowing him now, you know, watching him play, you know, physically, you know, standing behind him, watching him behind a kit. It's amazing. He has that magic touch.
He does. I think this episode can just be treated as all things Ringo. So why don't we just start with, can you give us some history on Ringo, a biography on him? You don't need to go too crazy detailed, but I think it's really cool to learn more about him as a person.
All right. Well, you know, Ringo was a sickly child in Liverpool. And spent a lot of time in the hospital at a young age, almost died a few times in the hospital. And while he was in there, you know, he said that that's where he had an interest in drums. You know, he said that the nurse would come by with a little cart with different instruments in it, and you know, to give the kid something to do, and he was just always attracted towards the drums. And when he was 15, his stepfather got him a used drum kit for Christmas, and Ringo said that he went upstairs. You know, he had a very small, you know, two up, two down. Flat in which he lived with his mom and stepdad, and it was like a row house, you know. So as Ringo started playing, the neighbors were telling him to, you know, keep the noise down. So that really started him the mindset that just didn't like practicing, you know. So he just loved playing with live musicians. And anyway, he got hooked up with Roy Storm and the Hurricanes. They were a big band in Liverpool. And Ringo spent a lot of time in the summers. They would have these 3-month gigs at these holiday camps. And, you know, when Ringo would be there playing with the band, they would play all kinds of music. So he really learned a lot of different styles. And from there, he went on to the Beatles when they made him an offer in August of 62. And the rest is history.
Now, how old was he at that point? So give me some ages here. So when he first got into music, just help me get the timeline.
He was about 13.
Okay. And then the next kind of, when he decided I'm going to be a professional musician.
Yeah, 15, 16.
Okay. And then how old was he when he started in the Beatles?
Well, he went in at August of 62. He was born in 40, so he'd be 22 years old.
Okay. And obviously he famously replaced Pete Best, who was the drummer before, who, when the Beatles, what's the story with that? What happened there with Pete Best?
You know, I guess there's a lot of different stories out there. You know, I sifting through a lot of the information, and this is my interpretation. You know, when the John Paul and George had an opportunity, they needed a drummer, so they asked Pete, and he obliged because he had nothing going on. But John Paul and George, it's pretty much factual. They had the drive, they had the desire, and obviously they had an overwhelming talent. Pete was just along for the ride, so he didn't have that fire in the belly, and I think it was just showing time and time again. And Ringo had it. And then I think that was the reason they wanted Ringo in the group, because he was of the same mindset and had the talent.
That makes sense. Okay. So then he gets in the Beatles. And as you said, the rest is history, where basically people see them on the Ed Sullivan Show. And Ringo is one of those guys who have come up in, I would say, you know, every second or third episode of Drum History, someone mentions the Beatles. If it's about Ludwig, if it's about vintage Japanese drums, about how that just kind of you know, that boom of making kids want to play the drums and learn basically stems from seeing Ringo play. So, I mean, I feel that he has kind of a responsibility of making the drums become such a popular instrument because, you know, before him, there was a lot of jazz guys, obviously, but it was just different, right?
Oh, yeah. And I was one of, you know, kids that got turned on by the Beatles. You know, I was seven at the time when I saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it was interesting for me because I was just a kid. I didn't have any interest in music at all. And when they came on, you know, I just saw the way my family reacted, and I just like late clocked on Ringo. And the following day, my parents told me that I was banging on empty coffee cans, and everything for me started right at that moment. So
that's so funny. Cool. Now, well, let's maybe pause here right in the middle, and then you can kind of talk about, we can go back and talk about the historical stuff, but then why don't you tell us what it is that you do, and then we can go back and talk about some of his gear throughout the years and all that good stuff. But so what got you into being basically an independent historian and curator of Ringo's gear?
Okay. As I said, you know, I was attracted to the Beatles when they hit the Ed Sullivan Show. And even though at an early age, I didn't know anything about drums, anything about music, I just found myself fascinated with drums. And I was zooming in on Ringo's kit. And I just remember, you know, looking at the album covers, you know, getting magazines when I could. And what had happened was I started noticing that there were some differences in Ringo's drum kits and the look of them as the years starting going by, you know, from 64, 65, 66. And I didn't realize till later when I was a young adult that, wow, Ringo actually had different kits. It just wasn't one Oyster Black Pearl kit. And I started doing more research, and it became a passion. And so along with research, I started collecting vintage drum kits, all specific to what Ringo used. And over the decades, I've managed to amass a collection of drum kits and gear, all specific to what he had. And by collecting, that really helped with my research. And in, 2002, I think, a gentleman by the name of Andy Babiuk came out with a book called Beatles Gear. And when I went through the pages and was focusing on the drums, I realized that a lot of the information that I researched was matching what he was saying. I just went to a much deeper level with drums. And at one point I thought, okay, you know, what do I do with all this information? And I thought I'd like to share it, you know, maybe because I knew there was other people that wanted a Ringo kit. And I figured if I created a website, ringosbeetlekits.com, that would allow people to learn about his kits, and the blueprint was there for them to go ahead and find what they needed. And for me, what ended up happening, here's where things go off the rails being a Beatles fan. It was late 2012. I got a call from the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, and they said, hey, I'm going to give you some confidential information here. We just signed an agreement with Ringo and his wife, Barbara. We're doing an exhibit on his life called Ringo, Peace and Love. And they said, so they're loaning us a lot of personal things, a lot of Beatle memorabilia. And among them, two key components are the drum kit Ringo used on the Ed Sullivan Show to indicate the beginning of his career with the Beatles. And then the maple kit, the one that Ringo used on part of the White Album, on Let It Be and on Abbey Road, to signify the end of his career with the Beatles. They said, but we've run into a problem. They said, even though Ringo gave us approval, when we contacted his people in London to obtain the kits, they said, you know what, nothing's organized. We just have all kinds of drums here. And so the people at the museum were frantically looking for information online, and all I kept finding was my website. So that's how I initially got involved working with Ringo.
That's awesome. So you are very much amongst drum nerds and friends here who are very interested, I think, in all the details about Ringo's drums, including his involvement with Ludwig, if that was always the case, what particular drums and finishes and all that stuff that I'm sure you know like the back of your hand. So why don't you kind of take us through Ringo's drums through the years?
Okay. Well, what had happened was Ringo had an Ajax drum kit, you know, like a lesser type model made in England that he was using. It was the first kit that he bought. In September of 1960, at a music store in Liverpool, he went in and he bought a Premier drum kit that had the color of a mahogany duroplastic, and it was a four-piece kit, you know, a 4x14 Royal Ace snare drum, a 12x8 tom, a 20x14 bass drum, and a 16x16 floor tom. So he bought that, and the reason he did was because the beginning of October, he was traveling with his band, Roy Storm and the Hurricanes, to play in Hamburg, Germany. And they, when they got there, they ended up being on the bill above the Beatles, but they were playing with them. And that's where Wow. we got to meet John, Paul, and George. And so Ringo used that kit extensively. And he had it when he joined the Beatles in August of 62. And it served him well. You hear that kit on the Beatles' first album, the Please Please Me album. So when you hear Twist and Shout, you know, that's that kit. Hmm. So what happened was in April of 63, you know, it was decided that Ringo really needed to step up to a high-end kit, and he always had a passion for wanting an American-made kit. And I talked to him about this, and he said that he went to a music store called Drum City in London with the Beatles manager Brian Epstein. And he said that there was this Oyster Black Pearl Ludwig kit there. And he said, that's what I want. So it was a smaller size kit, 12x8 tom. It was a downbeat set, a 20x14 bass drum and a 14x14 floor tom. So Ringo gets the kit, but he doesn't take ownership of it right then and there. I asked him about the snare drum because Ringo had a jazz festival snare drum, and it was documented that Ringo got the kit, you know, from Drum City in April of 63. But I told him that, going over and documenting his drum kits, I said your snare drum is somewhat unique. You know, it's not a traditional jazz festival that's 5x14. I said, did you know yours is 5.5x14? And he said, no, I didn't. And I says, well, you must have special ordered it. You know, I says, I don't know what kind of snare drum originally was with the kit when you bought it. And I says, but there's a stamp date inside your snare drum that says, you know, April 18th, 1963. So the snare drum was made in Chicago. It's, you must have special ordered it. You know, and he said, you know, he goes, I wanted a deeper sized snare drum. I wanted a deeper sound in the studio. So I said, wow, okay. So he answered that.
Yeah.
And with that particular snare drum, it lands up that he just bonded with it. That was like his snare. So he landed up using that snare all the way through the end of the Beatles. Even though he had different drum kits, that was his go-to snare drum. So what happened was when the Beatles were coming to the States for the Ed Sullivan Show, it was decided that Ringo would get another kit just like the one that he the Ludwig kit that he now had. And the reason was Brian knew that the Beatles were going to be filming A Hard Day's Night in March of 64. So they thought, okay, what better than to get the kit when we're in the States? So an order was placed through Drum City to the Ludwig Drum Company. And then the drum kit was delivered to Manny's Music Store in New York City. And so when Ringo came across with the Beatles, you know, he brought his snare drum, his Jazz Festival, mm-hmm. like, brought his cymbals, and they brought a new bass drum head that's, you know, with the Beatles Drop T logo. And so on February 9th, the same day that they performed on the Ed Sullivan Show, is when Ringo took possession of that kit. And so it was just used for a short period of time. And it's the same kit you see on the movie A Hard Day's Night. The drum head was changed for another Beatles Drop T logo. And in May 31st of 64, Ludwig provided Ringo free of charge with his first drum kit. And that was a super classic model, you know, the 13x9 tom, 16x16 floor tom, and 22x14 bass with another Jazz Festival, traditional 5x14.
Man, that was a good move on Ludwig's part there.
Yeah, and one thing that I found out about that, there was a gentleman by the name of Dick Shorey. He was an executive at Ludwig, and he's in his 80s, and we've become friends. And in fact, I was at his house last summer, asking him a lot of questions and interviewing him, and I learned some interesting things. He said that when after the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show, Bill Ludwig II gave Dick the job of being the liaison, working with Drum City and Brian Epstein to provide whatever Ringo would need. So he said that they were trying to figure out at that time, you know, what kind of kit can we give Ringo? You know, they're going to be playing in venues that are so unique at that time. How are we going to get the volume out? You know, and as you know, or maybe know, that, you know, when the Beatles performed, they didn't have monitors. They just had amps. And, you know, it was very, very simple. You know, and it was Ringo, you know, just pounding away in the background. So he said that, you know, he was sending different drums for Ringo to try. And he says, you know, one of them was even like a 24x14 bass drum. And it sounds like things got too complicated. So Ringo just settled on a super classic kit. Hmm. So the one that he had was made in 64. And he used that predominantly until he got his Maple kit in 68.
Wow.
So that was his go-to drum kit on a majority of the albums.
Now, is he a gear head?
No.
Like,
not at all.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. You know, it's like, he's like, give me the drums and I'll play them and I don't really care, you know?
Yeah. He knows what he wants sound-wise, but he's not a drum geek at all. Yeah, a little side note, because even a lot of times, if I'm with him and somebody brings up something about his gear or whatever, he'll just point at me and just say, ask him, I don't know. It was kind of cool.
That's awesome. You can speak for Ringo. You've earned that right.
Yeah. So, but anyway, we're getting close to the end here. So in 65, when the Beatles did their summer tour, Ludwig supplied Ringo with another super classic kit, and it was really just used for the tour, and then after the fact, maybe in the studio just for double tracking. But Ringo has a fondness for that kit. He calls it his Shea kit because that's the one he used, you know, at Shea Stadium in front of 7,000 people. And in 1968, it's kind of a cool story that I unearthed. The Beatles go to India. Ringo's only there for a few weeks, and he comes back early, but the other three are there. And Donovan, do you know of him?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So, Sunshine Superman, all that kind of thing. So he was influential in giving the Beatles a lot of inspiration. You know, he taught John and Paul like the claw hammer technique of guitar playing. And he mentioned to them that if they sanded the finish off their guitars, they would have more of an organic sound. And So that stuck with them, because when they came back, you know, John's had the finish sanded off of his J160 Gibson acoustic guitar, and then off of his Epiphone Casino, and then George sanded the finish off of his Epiphone Casino, and Paul sanded the finish off of his hard-bodied Rickenbacker bass.
Man,
so obviously they talked to Ringo about this, and Ringo decided to order a true studio kit. You know, he just thought something that was natural. So he just said, "I want one with wood." And I guess he was told that, you know what, that plastic wrap, that Oyster Black Pearl wrap around the drum shells is suffocating the sound. So that's why he just went with an all wood kit. And he just said, you know what, and I also want calfskin heads.
Whoa.
So he ended up getting that drum kit delivered September. I can't remember the exact day. In 68, but it was the same time that the Beatles were coming into the studio to record Glass Onion. And so what they did was, I think with Paul pushing a little bit, they experimented where Ringo took his one super classic kit that he was using from 64, and then he mixed in his Maple kit. You know, so he was trying double bass, and I guess but it just didn't work out. So that was scratched. Ringo used that kit with the Jazz Festival once again, and he used it both with calfskin heads and with Mylar heads or plastic heads. You know, and I think they changed up. You know, like when Ringo was playing on the rooftop, you know, that obviously the calfskin would have been difficult to deal with constant tuning. So
sure.
So they just went with the plastic heads.
Man, and it's funny because it seems so like now if someone says, oh, I went to the studio and I recorded a major album or major songs with calfskin heads, I'd be like, that's insane. No one does that. But I guess if you think about it, this isn't that long after the Mylar synthetic heads had been invented. I mean, that was what, like 57-ish, 56 that I think Evans and Remo were going at it. So this really isn't that far after that, where I guess they were still sort of, you know, in vogue a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually when Ringo went to the calfskin, it was almost like going back to what he originally started with, because his premiere kit, according to Ringo, had calfskin heads.
Hmm.
So I found that very interesting.
Yeah. That's cool. That's great. So was that, so then take it away from there. Take it. What else did he use?
That was predominantly it. So, but wow. What happened was, so Ringo, as of 2015, you know, ironically, he still owned, five of his, six original Beatle drum kits. The one that is lost to history was his premiere kit. When they made the deal with Drum City to purchase his first Ludwig kit, they took his premiere kit in on trade. And so what had happened was, it was May 12th of 63. The Beatles were performing on a TV show up in Birmingham, England, and it was a Sunday. So his kit was delivered then. You know, it was so he actually technically bought it in April, but he took possession of it on May 12th. And so his kit came back to the shop. I met and know the guy who detailed the kit before it was sold.
Oh, cool.
And his name is escaping me, unfortunately. But the cool way that I got in touch with this guy, I was documenting the 1964 super classic kit of Ringo's, I took off the top head off of his Tom, and there was a business card inside. Dave Golding was the guy's name. Dave Golding, Drum City. And I'm going like, oh my God, this has been in there for 50 years. And, so I land up finding him. I track him down. I called him, and it was funny because with him having the a British accent, and me trying to explain who I am and what I found, and him being in his 80s, it took a while to for it to click. But once it did, this guy was very sharp, very articulate. And then so he started telling me a lot of details, you know, and he said, I remember taking that kid in. And he said, I remember cleaning up. He goes, and I remember that there was a felt sash in the front that said the Beatles. And he says, it was just dirty and filthy. He goes, I threw it out. You know, and,
my God.
Yeah. So it was just an amazing story. And this guy had so much information, you know, he started out in 1963 at Drum City working in the service department. So he would be, you know, working on the kits, setting things up, you know, making the deliveries and things like that. And so he was the gentleman that installed the like Rogers Swivomatic tom mounts on Ringo's kits.
Hmm.
And, so he landed up leaving Drum City in 1967, and when he left as the store manager. So the information that he had given me was just so detailed and precise, and I landed up meeting other people that worked at Drum City that worked under him, and those three other gentlemen all said, Dave Golding said it. It's true,
man.
So it was great to learn that history.
Yeah. Well, and I think everyone owes you a debt of gratitude for actually taking these kind of oral histories like that and literally, you know, taking drumheads off and finding cards and getting to the bottom of it and then being able to, you know, put it all into one place. Now, I'm assuming because you didn't say anything about it and you said it was lost to history, that premiere kit is just, I mean, realistically, it could be in someone's garage or attic somewhere, Ringo's original premiere kit.
Yeah, it could be. There was a story that it landed up in Australia. You know, he said, I'm the guy who bought it, you know, and I said, please write down all the details, getting the kit, you know, like where you were, what you did, you know, and so he gave me a very detailed story. And unfortunately, some of the things that he said don't match up with Beatle history.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know what, this isn't really sounding like it's totally correct. So, you know, he have a photo of me, with the kit, that was in a newspaper, you know, and, in Australia, and he sent it to me. But it was really hard to make out the image, and you know, so if it was a clear image, then you could see the way the swirl patterns were or are on the drums of the, you know, mahogany duroplastic finish, and then match them up with pictures of Ringo's kit. So there's no real way to do that.
No, that's interesting. It's one of those things where, let's be realistic, everyone wants to be a part of Beatles history. So to say that, you know, I've got Ringo's original premiere kit is probably just, you know, it may be it, but if you can't tell, then, you know, who knows. But you mentioned that he used Roger Swivomatic hardware on there, which a lot of people did in that day because it was kind of the most advanced hardware. And I know Ludwig's stuff wasn't the best at that era, even up through the 80s and stuff. It wasn't great. But what other, so was he using like a Speed King pedal, I would imagine?
Yeah, Speed King pedal. And when Ringo started out early on with his premiere kit, you know, he had like an Ajax cymbal, you know, he had Zildjian's and Zinn.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, you know, which, I mean, anyone that I've found was pretty crappy.
Yeah, you see those in like in just looking through catalogs. It's always like, well, we offer Zinn or whatever, and these other like Gretsch had some, and it's just an interesting. I guess you got to sell a starter kit with something. So, this episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at forksdrumcloset.com. Well, that's really interesting. So now, where are these kits now? You said Ringo had 5 out of 6 of them. The premiere's gone. Where are they today?
Okay. Here's a story on those. In out of the 5 kits that he had in 2015, he sold one in December of 2015 at auction through Julian's Auctions. And a little bit of a background, just so all this makes sense. I should lie this in first. When I was going through Ringo's kits and putting everything back together, you know, at that time, majority of the hardware was all missing. You know, cymbals are missing, and I pitched the idea of, you know what, you can't just put these, you know, drum kits, if you ever do, and you know, out for display in a museum or something with the Beatles logo drum head missing, no stand, you know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's the Beatles, it's you, you know. So I said, I have an idea I want to throw by you. And I said, I go, I have a collection of drum kits and gear all specific to what you use. I said, let me provide that, the whatever is needed to bring your 5 drum kits back to life, to make them whole again. And a little side note, his maple kit was really, really in bad shape. It was, the hardware was oxidized. Mm. And, it was the inside of the shells smelled like mildew.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, we got to correct all this stuff. So he gave me the go ahead. So, you know, I was able to have all his kits right now look as they did when he used them. And so it was part of the process working with Ringo's drum tech, Jeff Chonis. You know, we ordered custom drum cases, road cases to put every kit in, and along with details of how to set them up. So like once I'm dead and gone, you know, everything is in the case to give direction as to how to properly set up the kit the way Ringo used it. But so that being said, going back to December of 2015, so Ringo has the auction, and he sold off his first Ludwig kit, and it sold for $2.1 million.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it did not include the snare drum, the jazz festival that came with it, the one that Ringo liked. He just said, that's not going anywhere.
Oh,
so
my God.
He kept that. So with the gear that I provided, you know, that was all documented, you know, for anyone that was looking to bid on the kit. And so the gentleman that purchased it was Jim Irsay, owner of the Indianapolis Colts. And, you know, so he was well aware, because in reality, with what he bought for $2.1 million was the tom, which was original, the floor tom, which was original, the bass drum, which was original, but what wasn't was the front bass drum head, the front hoop, the T-rods and claws, all of the stands, the Speed King pedal, the cymbals, the stool, all that was mine.
That was your donor.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Well, Ringo actually bought, you know, the things from me, but really Irsay didn't really get a lot, you know, original things from it. But he's a good guy. I was at his office twice, once to tweak the kit to have it set up right, and the second time we were doing a documentary on something, and I was asked to be there. But a little FYI, that drum kit is currently on display at the Creative Artists Agency in Los Angeles. You can Google it, but it's you can see it in the lobby. It's there free of charge to see. It's encased and be there. I installed it in November of last year, and it'll be there until November of this year.
That's awesome. Yeah, everyone should go check that out if they're in that area. Now, is he a drummer? Who the Colts owner who bought him?
No, just a big Beatles fan. He also owns, I think, 4 Beatle guitars.
Oh wow!
This possession, yeah, yeah.
Cool.
So things you can buy when you're a billionaire.
Yeah. I mean, you it's funny because before you were like 2 million, I mean, 2.1 million. And I'm like, that 0.1 is enough, is more expensive than any drum set that I could think of. So oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was the most, yeah. And so Ringo loved me after that one, you know, knowing what he had before I got involved. And you know what else is interesting about Jim Irsay? In November of 2015, a month before, Julian's had an auction of a variety of rock and roll memorabilia, and what went up for auction at that time was the Beatles bass drum head from the Ed Sullivan Show, and Jim Irsay bought that for $2,050,000.
Oh my God!
Yeah, so he's a big Beatles fan.
Oh man, that's crazy. Now, did Ringo? I mean, there's no judgment either way. Now, did he just keep that money or did he like donate that to, you know?
Actually, it's pretty cool. What Ringo did was he and his wife, Barbara, a number of years ago, started a charitable foundation called the Lotus Foundation. And they both know, you know, meaning Ringo and Barbara, that they have been blessed in their lives. So they formed this foundation to help people long after they're dead and gone. Majority of their fortune is just going to go, it's not going to the kids, it's going into the foundation to help people. And some of the things that is going to is, you know, there were certain things that were negative in Barbara and Ringo's life, as you know, sorry, the alcoholism, Ringo's daughter having brain cancer at one point. So there's certain things where every year money's going to specifics, and yet they also allow people to email them, write them, to suggest other charities. So they'll take a portion of the money every year and give it to someone, give portions to different causes. So
that's great.
So it's very, very touching, and so he's really well grounded. And just to be able to give back the way he is just a nice thing. Because, you know, when I first found out that Ringo was putting his drum kit up for sale, I'm going, come on. I go, 2 years ago, I just put it all together. You know, maybe I couldn't have done any of that. But once I understood, you know, that they needed the wow factor, and then once I understood that what Ringo's plans were, so... But that auction, I think, raised $9.2 million.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
With other gear that he was selling and stuff like that?
It wasn't only gear. It was just like, you know, things from, you know, different houses. Because they even sold off some of their properties. They're just downsizing because, you know, they're older. So it's like, you know, anything from like, you know, candelabras to, you know, clocks and just different personal items.
Wow. Yeah, it's all history. That's great. And then, so the other drum sets, did he keep his other original drum sets?
So the other four he has, they're all you know, in custom cases, as I said, and they're in a highly secured vault, you know, temperature and humidity controlled, and it's, you know, kept in this vault with other Beatles memorabilia that he still has.
Wow. Yeah. Man, that's so cool. It's good he's keeping them. And it's, in a weird way, it's like, it's just, hopefully everyone kept their first drum set. But I know personally, I sold mine for like $50. It was just like a little kind of, you know, junky percussion plus set. But every couple months, I'm like, man, I wish I had that. And Ringo's no different. I'm sure he's like, I wish I had that Premier kit. You know, I feel like that's just, you always, it's your first love.
Oh yeah, for sure. In fact, I can tell you a very cool story that really nobody knows, but and this just happened, and it's Beatle related, but not drum related, but it's still pretty cool. There was a gentleman that owned Ringo's crosswalk jacket, and what that is was the black jacket that you see Ringo wearing on the Abbey Road cover.
Yeah,
and brief story about that, you know, Ringo had it, and in 1980 he was in a relationship and that ended, and the jacket was left behind in this woman's care, and she just hung on to it, and she auctioned it off in 2001, and a guy bought it and hung on to it, and then he was planning on auctioning it this year. And what happened was when he contacted the auction house, the person that ran it, runs it, knows Ringo, and he said to the guy, he goes, you know what? He goes, would you be interested in maybe offering this to Ringo? He goes, I'm sure he'd like it back. So Ringo did want it back. And I know the guy who owns it or owned it. And so I get a call, and it was like, Garrett, can you call your friend and kind of massage this? I said, all right. So what ends up happening, the real short version, Ringo felt, you know what, I shouldn't have to buy back what was mine.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and this guy, a very nice person, great guy. You know, his version is, you know what, I bought this as an investment, you know, for my retirement. And, you know what, it's going to be tough just to give it back. So,
yeah.
So it, without going into all the details with numbers and things, a friend of mine that also knows Ringo steps in, and he's a wealthy entrepreneur, and he just said, I shared him the dilemma I was in, because I said, I went from a guy that was told to massage the deal to now it's my responsibility to try to talk this person into giving the jacket back to Ringo. And and I said, I felt like I never let him down with anything that I've done for him. And I go, I just feel like I'm boxed in. I don't know what I could do. Yeah. So this person said, you know what? Call a guy and make the deal. And he goes, and I go, yeah. I go, with what? You know, and he goes, I'll buy it. And he goes, I'll buy it and I'll give it to Ringo. And he goes, you know what? He goes, you're negotiating this. He goes, we're going to get it. And he goes, we're going to give it to Ringo. So
we made the deal.
And then, we're talking, and I said, well, how are we going to get this to him? I said, do we want to wait to his 80th birthday in July? And he said, no, we got to get it to him sooner. He goes, let's make it an early birthday gift. So I said, okay. So, Ringo has no idea about this. And in fact, when I keep getting asked, how you doing? I go, I'm working on the guy, you know, need more time. I go, but he's not going to auction it. So you don't have to worry about it. It's not going to go into another stranger's hands. And, so we had the jacket. We go to, I call, make an appointment to go to Ringo's house, on February 22nd, was a Saturday. And, so I fly in, and this other gentleman flies in, and we meet. And so he's got the jacket in a garment bag, which is what it came in from the this previous owner. And I said, I go, can't you just give it to him like that? I go, it should be gift wrapped. So we go into this store in Beverly Hills to get the jacket gift wrapped. And the woman said, hey, you know what? We're I'm short staffed. We're busy. Come back in an hour. And it's like, you can't leave this, you know?
So
we tell her, I said, here's what we got and here's who it's going to, you know? So boom, they took care of it. So we go to Ringo's house, and a little funny thing I have to tell you, we both get out of the car. Ringo's standing out in the driveway, and he puts his arms out and he goes, give me a hug, brother. So I give him a hug. And then this gentleman who does know Ringo, but not well, he comes up to Ringo with his arms out, and then Ringo backs up and throws out an elbow. He goes, elbow bump, I don't want germs. And then I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, this guy just spent a fortune.
Oh my God.
So we go into the house, and Ringo opens the box. When he takes the lid off, you know, the jack was covered with really fancy tissue paper. So Ringo jokingly says, oh, you got me a box of tissue paper. You know, so he sees the jacket, and it doesn't click. He goes, oh, you got me a black jacket. And then he pulls it out, and me and my friend are saying, that's history. That's your jacket. And he's going like, what? They go, that's your jacket. And he goes, Abbey Road? I go, yes. And he just went speechless. He just was staring at it, and he put it on. He puts his arm through the sleeve, and he says, I got short arms. He goes, this fits. This is my jacket. I go, your jacket. And he really got emotional, and he started walking down a hallway. And then so we start following him, and then he goes, "Let's walk like we're crossing the Abbey Road."
Oh my God!
And there was no pictures of that, but God. He got it. He thanked us, and then he just disappeared. And then I thought, God, that's weird. And because I thought he'd want to hear how he got it and things. And then Barbara comes out, and then she just said, "Thank you both very much. You just made my husband very, very happy."
And wow.
Then Ringo came out, and I guess he had to just compose himself, and he just thanked us, hugged us, you know, we had a nice conversation with him. And but he was just he couldn't believe. I guess he just kept saying, he goes, I can't believe they did this for me.
Mm.
That was a very special moment for me.
That's unbelievable. I mean, that you have the opportunity to do these things through your passion for the Beatles, which, I mean, from what I understand what you're saying, you basically built this business of, you know, being involved in this from the ground up, and look at where it got you. I mean, that kind of just goes to show that if you're dedicated and passionate about anything, you could hang out with Ringo. hang out with the Beatle.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating story. And for me, this is all very normal. I found that I'm not a starstruck person.
Yeah.
But I can see when I'm around Ringo, or if other celebrities are there, you see the way they respect him and treat him.
Yeah.
It just makes me realize, like I pinch myself. It's like, how did I get here? What are the odds? But the life story for me is like, follow your passion, because you never know where it's going to lead. And I've never expected anything. I never asked him for anything. Mm. All I keep doing is, even with this whole jacket and doing that, it makes me feel good, because the reality is, he's on my mind, in my life, the Beatles, him, every day, since the time I saw them at 7. So he's done so much for me and affected my life so much, for me able to do something positive for him and not expecting anything in return is very satisfying, just to say, thank you. And I think he respects me tremendously. I would say that with confidence, because I've never asked for anything, and he knows I have no hidden agenda.
Yeah, really.
And there was one time, after I put all his kits together and I did the auction and some other personal things, he would see me. I would never, try to start a conversation. I would just say, "Hey, how you doing?" And, but this one particular time, he just came in, sought me out, and he came up to me and just said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." He goes, "Thank you for everything you've done." And he said, "Because of your research," he said, "I've learned a lot of things I didn't know. And more importantly, you brought back fond memories of things that I had forgotten." And when he said that, I mean, I couldn't help but cry. So he's a great guy. I can't say enough about him. And we're not even talking about his drumming.
No, but I think him as a person is just, he is drumming. And I think that is the opposite of the whole "don't meet your heroes" kind of thing, because they're not, it might ruin it for you. It sounds like it was more than you ever thought possible. And he just seems like such a great guy.
Yeah. There's one thing that was interesting. There was one time Ringo was touring, and I was there for sound check. And I know Greg Bissonette, who drums with Ringo on tour. And Greg and I are good friends. So I'm standing behind Ringo. Ringo's playing "Boys." And I look over at Greg, and Greg's looking at me, and he has this habit of like smiling and sticking his tongue out and stuff, So. But I just noticed certain things about Ringo's playing, and I said to Greg, I go, "Hey, can we talk for a minute and just be serious?" I said, because I just really experienced something that just was like so obvious. And he said, "Yeah, what is it?" I said, I just noticed the little things, Ringo playing heel up, all that kind of stuff. I go, "But the point I wanted to make was, he's got that it factor." And I always say that, if you took an example of, you took one guitar, had it tuned, you had three guitarists that all know the same song, and you ask each one of them to play the song, one of them that has the it factor is going to have everybody going like, "Whoa."
Yeah. Exactly.
What are you doing? Ringo's got that. He's got it. And Greg just said, Gary, you're right. He goes, every time I play with him, he goes, you just feel it. And that's a big part of what he's got. You know, he's just got that magic touch.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. And it's just the right place, right time, the audio engineering technology, the recording technology changing at that time with Jeff Emmerich and all of this stuff. It's like a perfect concoction of everything is just right at that place. And I think Ringo's the perfect drummer and it's just an absolute icon. So now as we kind of wrap up here, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the bass drum head. I heard a story and just maybe you can fill me in on it. Isn't there something where like originally Ludwig didn't have their logo on the head? And then he wanted it painted on there because he was so proud to play Ludwig. You might have talked about it a little bit before, but isn't there something with that?
Yeah, the true story there is that when Ringo first saw his first Ludwig kit, it did say Ludwig. There was a Ludwig decal on the head, but the little twist is that Ringo said, you know, after he buys the kit, he said the salesman starts trying to peel the Ludwig decal off, and Ringo goes, "What are you doing?" He goes, "No, just leave that on. It's Ludwig. It's American." He goes, "I want that on."
Oh man, so, why was he peeling it off? Like, what is that something they did?
I have no idea. Ringo didn't say.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So, but what happened was, when you look at early pictures of Ringo playing that kit. And if you can kind of trace a timeline, you'll notice that you'll see that Ludwig decal keeps, you know, from right to left, it just keeps losing letters. And the one story that I heard was that John would always pick at it, and he got it down to where it just said LU, and then he would be making jokes on stage about Ringo and the loo, or, you know, bathroom jokes.
Oh, that's funny.
So, but then the decal was completely removed, and then it was painted on.
Wow, cheeky John!
Yeah,
that's great. Any other just little Ringo stories? Well, let me ask you this too. So, is there any truth to the comments that people will say that Hal Blaine played on certain Beatles songs, or Bernard Purdy played on Beatles songs?
Yeah, you know, it's all Ringo. And in fact, you know, a few years ago, I did a talk at the Delaware Drum Show, and then Bernard Purdy was also there as a guest to do a talk. And all I kept getting was, you know, some of the people were coming up thinking it was going to be, all right, Gary, you're going to call him out? And it's not doing that. And, you know, and Bernard is a very, very nice guy, but why he ever said that and why he sticks to it, I have no idea. That there's no proof. I mean, you know, Ringo's drumming is so distinctive.
Yeah.
All the isolated tracks now that you can listen to, it just doesn't fit. And interestingly, at the drum show, I was the first one to talk, and then about an hour later, then Bernard did his session, and when he was finished, you know, there was packed, you know, so he set the table by saying, "Okay, I'll take questions, but," you know, it was basically, "I'm not going there," you know. It was like he knew, you know, and but he just shut it down before it even got started, and he's a very nice guy and very talented. Just a gentleman.
Yeah, that's funny. And he's just known as being like the boastful kind of like, "I'm the best" kind of guy. Very nice. But maybe it was like it started as like a, you know, "I'm the man, I could play with the Beatles." And then it just turned into something crazy from there. But cool. Well, the Beatles are sort of surrounded with conspiracies and things, obviously. So that's also probably part of it, with like, you know, the whole Paul is dead thing. Maybe that's Ringo's conspiracy.
Yeah.
Well, any other fun little Ringo tidbits you might want to share? Like, I mean, he seems like a great guy. Anything back in like the far out days of the mid 60s that were worth sharing?
There's a lot of things. I am working on a book, so there's a lot of cool things that are going to come out. But what I found an interesting thing that I would note is that normally if people have an opportunity to meet Ringo, they're normally told, okay, you know what, if you meet him, don't freak out. Don't go bringing up the Beatles. You know, don't turn it into a grand, Inquisition. And just chill. But for me, Ringo knows me is like this Beatle drum guy. So he likes to share information. And it's sometimes if I never say, hey, I got a list of questions here. I'll just kind of say something during a conversation. And one little thing I can tell you, there was a gentleman that worked for Zildjian named John De Christopher. He was like artist relations. And he had sent me a text. Ringo was on tour, and he said, Gary, he goes, I'm going to be seeing Ringo. And he goes, check this picture out. And it was a photo of a Zildjian symbol. And he goes, I'm going to give this to him. So what happens is he gives it to Ringo, or he gives it to Ringo. And they don't really connect. Ringo doesn't really play it, whatever. So a few weeks later, I'm with Ringo, and Ringo says, hey, he calls Greg Bissonette over, and he goes, what's the name of that symbol? And then, Greg says, Zin. And he said, Gary, he goes, what's a Zin symbol? He goes, a guy gave me a Zin symbol, and he says, I used it. He goes, I never used it. I never even heard of Zin. So I said, actually it did. and he goes, it did? I said, yeah. So he tells Jeff Chonis, his drum tech, he goes, you got that cymbal? Can you bring it here? So Jeff brings it. And then so I said, Ringo, I knew in advance that this guy was giving it to you. I go, so I have a picture on my phone. I go, it's from 67. You're sitting behind your drum kit in Abbey Road Studios, and you can see a portion of the cymbal. You can see the Zin cymbal stamp. And you could even, and it was a sizzle symbol. I said, you can even see one of the rivets. So unfortunately, the Zin symbol that this guy gave Ringo, that John gave Ringo, had like a more modern Zin logo. So Ringo's looking at it and he goes, I can't see it that closely on the phone. I said, well, if it was on a TV screen, you'd be able to see that it's a Zin. I go, and that's what you played. So he says, well, what does this sound like? I go, every Zin, I go, I found was like, not sounding too good. I go, I don't know how you got such a good sound out of yours. So Ringo says, well, let's try it. So I'm given the cymbal, and I got my index finger through the center hole. And then Jeff gives me a drumstick to hit it. And everybody's standing in a circle. And all of a sudden I go to hit it. And I look at Ringo. I go, what am I hitting it for? You hit it. I go, you're the one with the magic touch.
Hey, you're Ringo.
Yeah. So he hits it. And we all just look at each other. And he's like, yeah, it does suck.
Yeah.
So, but it was just, but the cute part is, yeah, he's not a techie. I didn't even know what brand symbols he was using.
That's so funny. Yeah. I can't believe that he used that Zin, which again is just like that's just not sheet metal, but it's just like a,
Yeah. And it's funny because it was like a 5-rivet, sizzle. And so you hear it on songs like, say like the final hit, on the cymbal at the end of like In My Life.
Yeah.
You hear it on With a Little Help from My Friends. You hear it on Something.
Wow.
It just sounds good.
Well, it's got to be part of that could be the amazing recording techniques they were experimenting with and all that. So that's unbelievable.
You know what else is interesting too is with his drum kit tuning, especially towards the end with, using a lot of the tea towels and things, that there was some person that I cannot remember their name, just said that he was in the studio and he says, nobody was there. So he said he was Gary, because I was hitting like the Ringo's heads, and he goes, everything just sounded like out of tune and crappy. However they did it in the studio, it worked.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a, that everyone kind of, if you're experienced in recording, you know that if it sounds sort of crappy in the room, then you go in the control room and it's going to sound great. You know, that's not always the case, but it'll sound better in recording because you can, you know, you kind of want that more flat sound as opposed to a way cranked snare. So, man, you're like, you are Ringo's living memory. You know what I mean?
Yeah, which is kind of, it's an honor. It really and truly is. Yeah, I'm not a religious guy, but I am blessed beyond belief to
absolutely
this as a fan.
Well, it's your hard work and your dedication, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share all this with us today. And before we wrap up, I want to give a quick shout out to Andy Dwyer, who reached out via Facebook and was just recommending some people, and he helped get us connected. So I really appreciate it. I love when all you guys and girls out there do that and can help out with the show. So yeah, Gary, why don't you tell people where they can find you? Tell them your website. You said you're working on a book. Give us that whole run through and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. Well, the website is Ringo's Beetle, singular, kits, plural, .com. And the contact information is there. The book is, it's been a slow process, but, too many distractions, but that's coming along. Right now it looks like it'll be coming out, first quarter, second quarter of next year.
That's great. And
you have a lot of information that never been told.
That's cool. And you obviously do presentations on this, like you mentioned at like the Delaware Drum Show with Joey Boom. And
there's the Chicago Drum Show. Hopefully that's going to take place in May. And
yes,
actually I'm going to the UK in October for the vintage drum show there in Coventry.
That's great.
Yeah. And then I got a few other talks I'll be doing around the country while I'm in the UK, like in London at I can't remember the name of the place, but in you know, London, Wales. So,
man,
yeah,
follow your dreams. You know, you can. This is what can happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's everybody, follow your dreams, follow your passions, because you never.
Yeah, know. Great. Well, Gary, as Ringo says, peace and love, and sure. I appreciate you being on the show. Thanks so much, and I recommend. I'll put all your info in the show notes, and everyone should keep an eye out and go check out Gary at a drum show near you.
Thanks, Bart. I appreciate it.
Hey, guys. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I wanted to mention real quick, I didn't say this in the episode, but Gary is available to be hired as a speaker for events and drum shows and all kinds of things. They are presentations on Ringo and his Beatles gear and also his story, Gary's story, about how preparation meets opportunity. Each of the talks is tailored to the specific audience, so it can be Beatles fans or drummers or general public or anything like that. So Gary's a great guy, so check out his website for more information. If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning. This is a Gwyn Sound Podcast.